Now Jeff Blair can tell you bedtime stories. Subscribe to podcasts of The Jeff Blair Show at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher and listen anytime you want. Sweet dreams. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. There's no such thing as a reasonable listening level. Just blare it. This is The Jeff Blair Show on Toronto Sports Radio. Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
All right, welcome back to the Jeff Blair Show with Richard Deitch. Happy Inauguration Day, everybody. Mr. Deitch.
Good morning, everybody.
That, by the way, is Propagandy. Fine band from Portage La Prairie, Manitoba. Home of the Portage Collegiate Institute Trotters. At least it used to be. I think they changed their name. We used to kick their ass.
First off, I appreciate the start of the show, American Idiot. I have no problems with that. And I know this whole show is going to be the music drops. Great job by the producers. Will be rebellion music, correct?
Well, I don't know about rebellion. There's supposed to be a little bit of tongue-in-cheekedness in it, but I don't know. The listeners picked it. And quite frankly, there were a couple. I mean, everybody picked End of the World. I'm not going to play REM End of the World. That's like...
Nah. Do we get any like Violent Femmes or anything from like Britpop in the 70s? Because, you know... As you know, we're both Clash fans, Jeff.
And yeah, that's
so much rebellious or rebellion music comes from that era.
The Guns of Brixton would be good, but we decided to go with a Joe Strummer song instead, just because I can.
So no,
no Clash, no Clash,
no Celine Dion and Katy Perry today is what you're saying.
No Celine. We never play Celine Dion or Katy Perry. You're gonna have to explain this. That's Richard Deitch, by the way, of Sports Illustrated, the Richard Deitch tour coming to an end today.
So no, back to the States.
No, I'm sure they'll let you in.
I honestly would say it's 50-50 at this point.
When you get to the border, ask to speak to Murray. He'll let you in. So Deitch, you sent out this tweet.
You're really gonna spend time on this? All right,
okay. I don't get it. If life was the WWE, which I presume is wrestling, right?
Right.
Biden drops in like crow sting.
You want me to explain that part? Yeah.
Takes out Trump. Pence does a turn, takes out Roberts. Biden and Pence run the U.S.
All right. I'll explain this literally in 60 seconds for your audience. All right. Sting is a very famous wrestler.
I haven't heard of him?
I have no idea, but I guarantee some of your audience, especially those under 40, will have. So he's a famous wrestler. He had a phase where he sort of dressed like the Crow, that movie.
Oh, God.
And he would rappel in from the audience and take out people like Hulk Hogan and Kevin Nash and others. So he
is
would
Baron
come...
Von Raschke here at the...
No. Time? So basically, oh, okay. Sting comes down. He takes out Trump if Vince McMahon's running this. Mike Pence does a heel turn. So he instead of being with Trump, goes up on the stage, takes out Supreme Court Justice Roberts... And then it's Biden and Pence in the middle of the ring, essentially, holding arm in arm up. You don't expect it, and that's how the show ends. That's how WrestleMania ends. And, you know, well, you got Monday Night Raw on Monday. So basically, that's my quick premise of this tweet. By the way, congratulations on the Jeff Blair Show. This has to be the first time you've talked wrestling in at least 5 years.
No, I always mention wrestling whenever we're forced to talk about MMA. You know, when Brent decides he wants to talk about MMA, I always mention wrestling because they're one and the same as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, we've had this debate earlier in the year, in the week. You don't agree with me that MMA fighters are incredible athletes. Are you the one who said that's ridiculous?
No, well, God, no. They're great athletes. Okay. So are wrestlers. Well, wrestlers are phenomenal athletes.
Maybe it was Bob who said that. Yeah, I mean, listen, obviously wrestling is scripted entertainment, but the athleticism of these men and women are incredible. To grind 300 days a year... on the road to do those kind of athletic feats, you got to be a great athlete.
Wrestling. Oh, 100%, yeah. No, they're probably all on roids.
Some of them may be on something. I honestly believe that in 2016, they have cleaned that up far more than it was in the 80s and 90s. But you do see physiques, and you do maybe even less about, Jeff, maybe even less about sort of muscle building and more about like maintaining, you know, and the ability. Like a lot of, I think, baseball players... probably took PEDs as much to recover, right? In addition to get strong.
Oh, 100%. It was less about the use of performance-enhancing drugs was, not always about hitting the ball farther. It was about being able to get back in the weight room
like if
three
you're
a, hours
if,
after.
If you're Roger Clemens, right, you want to be able to train the next day.
And I mean, I remember Darren Fletcher when he was catching with the Toronto Blue Jays, and we would talk about performance-enhancing substances because they knew that Darren just looked at Darren's body. There was no way he was going to.
Right.
But anyhow, he used to talk all the time about, hey, you know what? He said, at least in the initial phases, he said, I had way more suspicions about pitchers doing it than I, as far as teammates are concerned, than I did about hitters. For that reason, because it's all about it's all about recovery as much as. And look, I would never, you know, as far as athletes go, I think guys in or not just guys, but the women, the competitors in WWE are great athletes, but they really don't. If you look at a wrestling card, there's an inordinate amount of preening, standing around, flexing. There's not as much. If you look at wrestling from 40 years ago and look at wrestling now, there's way less activity now, way less athleticism. It's more preening and yapping and play acting.
Do you, as someone who is a Hall of Fame voter, how do you view...
How the hell do we get from WWE to Hall of Fame?
Trust me, this is a good segue. How do you feel about... like the taking of amphetamines in the 70s and 80s. Do you look at that in the same way?
I took amphetamines in the 80s.
So you're fantastic with it.
Okay, well, right. I mean, I don't know if I'm fantastic with it.
I just always wonder if there's a post-90s moralizing with
100%.
Steroids versus whatever was going on in the 70s 100%. And 80s.
In a former life, I used to make an appearance on another station. Well, it's not around anymore. The TV network, The Score.
Yeah, yeah. Home of Adnan Virk and Rene Paquette.
And the great Greg Sansone, who's one of the guys who runs things here. And actually, Sansone used to be the host. We used to have Jim Traber on. And Jim Traber's a talk show host in the States, a former major league player. And I can remember one time we had a debate about steroids. And he was very, of course, you know, the former player, hammering in guys that took steroids. And I said, well, you know, look, I know anecdotally from talking to people who played back in the 50s, 60s, and all you have to do is read Jane Levy's terrific book on Mickey Mantle. I mean, the amount of stuff those guys pumped into their bodies, it wasn't steroids, but it was amphetamines and God knows what else. You know, to me, that was as much a performance-enhancing substance as steroids. And right. Traber said to me, how could you call it a performance-enhancing substance? He said, I mean, the fact of the matter is a lot of us, we couldn't get out and play on Sunday afternoon unless we took them. And I said, well, isn't that the ultimate performance-enhancing substance then? If you need this to get out and play, to me, that's the ultimate performance-enhancing substance. So, no, that's one of the issues I have with the moralizing is that guys in the 70s and the 60s, 70s, and 80s didn't take stuff. That's not true.
Right.
They did.
Absolutely.
I would be very surprised if Hank Aaron didn't pop a greenie every now and then.
What would they have done maybe you don't know this, but what would they have done in the 20s and the 30s, the Ruth Gehrig era, to try to go back-to-back and to try to maintain their energy?
That I have no idea.
I just wonder. But you figure it must have been something, right? Coffee?
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure caffeine tablets existed then. But, and this is this is one of the reasons that I think that kind of hammering on PEDs can be a bit of a slippery slope is, you know, everybody has tried and does try to do something to get around.
Right.
And they just do. And my argument has always been, we're still finding amateur athletes who flunk drug tests. So you're going to tell me if amateur athletes are flunking drug tests, that athletes who aren't making $18, $19, $20 million a year, that they don't have access to the type of science that might be untraceable or is a little ahead of the cheaters. That's why I'm really reluctant to look at a guy and say, this guy absolutely took steroids. This guy absolutely didn't take steroids. I don't know. I can't, and I won't look at a player anymore and say, that's a steroid guy, that isn't a steroid guy. Because I got to tell you, I've said this, the first athletes I suspected of using steroids were hockey players, because the first locker room / dressing room, the first time I was in a room like that where you saw guys with, you know, the big backs and the acne and all that, was hockey. It wasn't baseball. So I will never say that a guy didn't use steroids or that a guy didn't use performance enhancing substances, because I just don't know.
One of our listeners dropping in about the Doc Ellis and the perfect game, right, on LSD.
Yeah. Absolutely. So anyhow.
Yeah. It's a great discussion though about sort of where the moralizing should or should not be. And we're not going to get into it today, but I'm always fascinated as if there is anything we should do about the athletes in the 60s and 70s who did not win Olympic medals because places like the East Germans had systematic doping. And should we look back and post-actively give them medals if we know that they doped? It's hard to do.
That's a slippery slope. I mean, you know.
Shirley Babashoff, do you know that name?
Yes.
Very famous swimmer in the States who probably, if the East Germans forfeited those medals, is like basically the Phelps of her generation because she wins all these golds instead of silver.
Well, scientifically, going back to the Olympics in Berlin, we know that the Germans were doping.
Right.
Now, it wasn't called doping them then, but we know that they were experimenting with hormones. So, you know, this is my argument about going back and kind of rewriting the record book, or going back and, you know, stripping people of Olympic medals. Well, where do you stop?
It's a good question.
And who, you know, more to the point, who decides where you stop? Anyhow, it's a good argument.
Yeah, it was great lead into John Morosi.
Yeah, it is, absolutely. So Morosi, now, as if today wasn't bad enough, and by the way, condolences on the next 4 years, as if today wasn't bad enough, you tweet out that Jose Bautista is thinking of or is a candidate to play in the outfield for the Dominican Republic at the World Baseball Classic. Why? Why would he do this to me? Why would he do this to us?
First of all, gentlemen, I did note the standings this morning. The Wings, only 4 points behind the Leafs, so look out. Of course, big matchup at the Joe next week. I wanted to make sure I mentioned that first. Jose Bautista.
This happens every time he comes on, you know?
Pardon?
Every time you come on, you make it about hockey.
Yeah. And I have a question about Morosi that's going to be nothing about baseball. Okay. It's going to be his semantics of how he does interviews on the station.
Okay, but anyhow, go ahead. Go ahead. Continue your thought. Now
okay,
you got
very good.
Now you got Morosi's head.
The Bautista question.
Yes.
And I guess I'll preface it by saying I have been to a hockey game more recently than a baseball game. I was at Montreal versus Detroit, the Battle of New France at the Joe on Monday.
The Battle of New France?
So I was there.
What the hell is the Battle of New France?
Well, Jeff, you understand there was this history, right, where the French were actually in your part of the universe, and the two trading capitals were Montreal and Detroit. You're familiar with that history, correct?
No.
Okay. Well, we don't have time for that now. I'll shift now to the WBC.
No, but I know the whole New France thing, but what the hell does Detroit have to do with New France? It wasn't part of it.
Yes, it was.
It was?
Yes.
Oh, Jesus, I got to look this up.
Detroit? Detroit?
Okay, all right. Go ahead. Enough with the Canadian history lessons.
Jose Bautista, WBC.
Yes.
He wanted to play on the team in 2013. There was a little pushback based on, I believe, injuries, contractual status from the Jays at the time. Couldn't do it. His country wins the tournament. So as a result, I think he wants to get back there and try to defend the country's championship in the 13 WBC here now in 2017. And, Jeff, I've got to tell you, the outfield for the Dominicans, stellar. He'll be joining Nelson Cruz, Marcel Ozuna, Gregory Polanco, Starling Marte, the infield, Beltre, Machado, Cano, potentially Carlos Santana at first base, Gary Sanchez behind the plate. This is an excellent team that very easily could win the tournament again. So I'm sure Jose, who's a very proud Dominican, wants to be part of the team this time around. So I totally get why he wants to play.
I'm worried he's going to blow something out.
Well, he'll be ready. And the thing about it, Jeff, is for position players in particular, it's the middle of March. You're already playing games. And I think that you're not going to be trying any harder to get a hit in this game than you would be if you were playing for the Jays against the Phillies in Clearwater. It's the same mentality, the same approach for the position players. Again, pitchers, I understand more of the trepidation, but position players, you're already game ready. I see very little downside, very little risk for the position players. And as much as people talk about the risks of playing in the WBC, I will note this. Derek Jeter, who represented his country as often as he could in this tournament, he had his best year of his career when he almost won the MVP in 06. that was a WBC year for him. They're playing for Team USA.
All righty. Go ahead.
Oh, that was a good. I thought, Jeff, I was so ceding to you. All right, John.
No, I just, I don't like my guys playing in the world. I want the World Baseball Classic to stop because I'm worried that people are going to get hurt.
John, first, I am interested in how you evaluate the moves around the Jays in the offseason, particularly the Red Sox, who I think, just even solo with the addition of Chris Sale, to me are the favorites in that division. And I think if you look at that rotation, obviously with Porcello, Sale, David Price, you're not going to have a long losing streak. Before that, John, I do want you to comment on this. I've been on Bob's show this week, and Bob said more than anyone else who is a guest on 590, you compliment the person asking the question by saying, "That's a good question, Bob." Bob's premise is that you're not saying it because you really think it's a good question. You're saying it to sort of take a momentary pause so you can set yourself up for an answer. So it's basically about you, John Morosi, as opposed to about Bob McCowan and his questions.
Well, I don't know about that. I guess I would say this, Richard, that the question, first of all, it's a great question.
There you go.
Second of all, it's a quality question that does, I guess in working both ways here, it does promote and require thought. And so, yes, is that a vocal pause or a vocal tick, if you would say, perhaps? But I certainly do not respond that way if the question is not worthy of such a response. I guess is what I would say.
All right, now,
and that's being sincere. I do say that in multiple interviews, probably in every interview I do, but only, Richard, to the very great questions of which. That last one by you certainly was one.
All right, John, that's a fantastic. John, that's a fantastic answer.
Just making my hip waders on here with all the bull that's being
right.
Slaughtered.
That said, John,
son of a country lawyer, Jeff. You do know that I am the son of a country lawyer. That is in my heritage.
All right, well, John, after that ridiculous PR spin that you just gave us, what are your thoughts on the American League East?
Well, thank you, Richard. I would say this: the Red Sox offseason has, in my judgment, affirmed their status as the front runner. I agree with you about the Chris Sale trade. Their overall club, I think, is strong among position players. Can't wait to see what Mookie Betts does for an encore after his phenomenal year. I think Sandoval bounces back, and I think he'll be a contributor for them. Hanley Ramirez seems to now have settled in, but they're going to miss David Ortiz. I mean, let's not forget, David Ortiz is the reigning and, of course, retiring winner of the Hank Aaron Award in 2016. He had a phenomenal season. So it is not a trivial task for them to replace David Ortiz's bat in that lineup, and it does look a lot different than it did when number 34 was there in the middle part of the lineup. So that's my concern there from Boston's standpoint. Toronto, I look at them, and their bullpen has to be better. They have to replace, by my count, at least two relievers. Cecil has not been replaced yet, nor has Benoit. And the lineup, frankly, it's been a minus of Encarnacion and Saunders and a plus of Pierce and Morales. That, to me, is not a good exchange. So the lineup, not as good. The bullpen, as we speak today, not as good. The rotation should still be solid. And you'll have, of course, a full year of Liriano, who I think was a very underrated pickup there by the Jays at the deadline. The rest of the division, I'll say this. The Yankees are still pretty young. Excited to see what Sanchez can do over a full season. What can Tanaka do for an encore after really a very solid year, a solid underrated year by a Yankee starter, which is hard to believe, but it's true. Tanaka was underrated as a very star pitcher for the Yankees in 2016. And my sleeper team, I had talked a lot about the Rays last year entering the season. I thought they'd be good. They weren't, but I like the moves they've made. They haven't totally deconstructed their pitching rotation, so I like the Rays as a sleeper team if Archer bounces back and the rest of that rotation bounces back as well.
John, as we sit here on January 20th, you look around Major League Baseball, and you can expand it beyond the American League. Is there a team that you look at and think to yourself, okay, this is a team that's really incomplete? You know, we saw Houston. Houston made a great pickup, I think, getting Luis Valbuena. I mean, I can't say enough about the offseason Houston's had. But is there a team that you're looking at right now and going, God, they just didn't do enough? And this is just not a complete team.
Well, a couple of things. And then first of all, Valbuena is going to the Angels.
The Angels.
Right, yeah. So they picked him up yesterday in agreement that Ken Rosenthal reported.
Still like the Astros, anyhow.
Right, right, right. Well, and actually, Jeff, I'm glad you brought up the Astros because I want to make this point about them, that they are one starting pitcher short of being a legitimate World Series contender. And when you've made it as many moves as the Astros have made to your everyday club, they sign Reddick, mm-hmm. they sign Beltran, they trade for McCann. All positive moves, in my judgment. But they are behind, I believe, the Indians from a standpoint of their total club.
Right.
And Keiko, I think he can bounce back and have a solid year. McHugh is never going to miss a lot of bats. They signed Charlie Morton, which to me was a bit of a head-scratcher.
Mm-hmm.
If they get Quintana, and their farm system, I believe, guys, is good enough for them to do it.
Right.
If they get Quintana, the Astros immediately become a legitimate World Series contender. I think, Jeff and Richard, that when you've got a good club and you've got a team that has stars, in some cases superstars in their prime, Altuve, Correa, Springer.
Yeah.
This is a really good team. And when you have a really good team and you have an obvious hole, as the Astros do in their rotation, and you don't address it, I have a much bigger issue with that than from some of these teams that are mediocre and are not taking a step to become slightly less mediocre and maybe go from 84 wins to 86 wins. The Astros have a chance to win the World Series with one more starting pitcher. I'd love to see them get that starting pitcher now as opposed to scrambling around for whatever's healthy and available there in the month of July.
You know, it's interesting, John. You mentioned the Indians, and I think as sort of out of the box as this might sound, I think we're undervaluing them. They were 94-67 last year, and a really, really impressive home team. And they land Edwin Encarnacion. And, you know, maybe and I realize it's going to be thought of differently here in Toronto than elsewhere. But in another year, that kind of addition would have led, you know, the sports centers of the world. That is bringing a premier A-plus power hitter to an already excellent team. So I wonder if we're even maybe under, and everybody else is back on the Indians, are we undervaluing the Indians a little bit, especially with the offseason additions?
Well, Richard, they should be the favorites in the American League. I think there is no question about that, in my mind at least. And you're right about Encarnacion. I think he is conservatively one of the best five pure power hitters on the planet right now. He's that good. It's in the book. You can see his numbers every year, the consistency. And they've always needed, Richard, I think, one more righty power bat, I mean, at least for the last several years. Encarnacion certainly is that. And let's not forget, too, Michael Brantley should be back.
Right.
Who was really a non-factor for them, who was once an MVP finalist not long ago, but of course he had the shoulder surgery. We'll see how he does bouncing back and if he can really become himself again. But you look at the continued growth of Kipnis, Lindor, who was one of my favorite players in the game to watch, love his personality, love his charisma, love the fact that he's a young Jimmy Rollins for me when you look at what he can do on the field. You add those players in there with a healthy Brantley. Jose Ramirez really emerged with all his versatility and really the lightning in his bat. I love him as a player, too. This is a really good lineup on top of, Richard, the fact that, remember, in the playoffs,
right,
Salazar and Carrasco were not part of the rotation because of injuries, and now they're expected back. So, and of course, now you have a full season of Miller. I could go on and on. The only caveat, really, Richard, is that in baseball, strangely enough, the teams like the Nationals a couple of years ago, when you look at it and say, how can this team lose? It's the perfect team. Well, often those teams lose. So it's very rare that the team that wins the offseason also wins the regular season. And why is it the case in baseball? Hard to say. We've got, notably, and I love making this point now, in baseball, we've had more franchises since 2000 win the World Series than win the Super Bowl. We talk so much about the parity in the NFL. Well, the parity in baseball, at least at the championship level, guys, is better. We've had more franchises win in this century than we've seen in the NFL. So I think, Richard, I'm with you 100%. They are the favorites of the American League. They should be the favorites of the American League. I agree with you in every possible way, but for whatever reason, injuries, whatever it is, it almost rarely happens that the team that we're talking about in January and February actually wins the championship in October.
Conversation with John Paul Morosi, MLB insider for the MLB Network. Interesting tweet sent out by Bryce Harper, and I know they were referring to it in the MLB Network this morning, essentially saying that suggesting that he thinks that the Nationals still have some moves to make, still have some additions to make to their lineup. when you look at that team, and you made the point, you brought the Nationals up in your last comment. And a lot of us expected the Nationals to be world, you know, have a real shot at the World Series last year. We'll probably think the same thing this year. What does that team still need in your mind?
You know, Jeff, I look at that club right now, and there are questions at first base with Zimmerman and his overall progression and his decline really in the last couple of years. Jason Worth is getting up there in years as well in left field. There have been some whispers about maybe they would pursue Matt Wieters even after trading for Derek Norris behind the plate. But the thing, Jeff, that interests me the most is how the interplay goes between Adam Eaton and Bryce Harper in the Nationals outfield. Because you've got two people that, to borrow the hockey term, bring a lot of sandpaper to the lineup. Okay, they both have an edge to their game, an edge to their personality. And I had a scout tell me after the trade was made between the White Sox and the Nationals at the winter meetings, watch this potential conflict because they are so alike. And that's going to be really interesting to see the dichotomy between Eaton and Harper. Now, they may get along famously, but they also could clash because they have that same chip on their shoulder, attitude, in addition to talent. I cannot wait to see how this unfolds. And, of course, Jeff, one point I'll make on this as well is that for the first time, Bryce Harper is going to play next to someone in the outfield with the Nationals who is more a part of the Nationals' future than he is, because Eaton is signed for more years than Harper is. Of course, Harper just 2 years left before he becomes a very highly sought-after free agent. But he has to be better. Harper has to be better himself. And I love his engagement, his passion that he has for his team. He did not have a very good year last year. And there's been so much talk back and forth. Was he hurt? Was he not? The Nationals have taken great strides to say he was not hurt. Well, if he wasn't hurt, then why did his numbers regress so much after that memorable weekend at Wrigley where Madden refused to pitch to him?
Right.
I mean, this to me is one of the huge questions of baseball. It might even actually be the biggest one. Who is Bryce Harper? Is he the next face of baseball in the United States? Is he the best player on the planet? Or is he a good but not great player, which is what he was in 2016? So I think that for him, that's a huge question. I'd also point out his maybe doubts and questions about his club, I think, probably relate to the pitching staff. And with the health of Strasburg being a huge question mark, the health of Joe Ross being a question mark. Right. They traded Reynaldo Lopez. They traded Lucas Giolito to get Eaton. So they've traded away their starting pitching depth behind a rotation with Strasburg and Ross that has two huge health question marks, especially with Strasburg in year one, mind you, of that seven-year, $175 million extension. And Strasburg, obviously, as we know, was not healthy at the end of the year. So I think a lot of questions, most notably, guys, in the starting pitching area there for the Washington Nationals.
Yeah, and should mention, of course, that it's a great point about Bryce Harper because, I remember talking to a couple of agents at the winter meetings, and we were looking ahead, as a lot of people in baseball are, John, to that big free agent class, the Bryce Harper, Manny Machado free agent class. You know, and this agent was making the point that, look, if Bryce Harper's available, he's going to make a lot of money. But, you know, 2 years ago, people were looking ahead and saying, my God, he could become the first $500 million player. And as I said, he's going to make a lot of money. But you know as well as I do that if you put 10 scouts in a room right now, John, people would be surprised how many of them would choose Manny over Bryce Harper, Manny Machado over Bryce Harper.
And
people would be surprised to know that, I think.
Yes, they would be. But to be honest with you, Jeff, I probably would at this point in time.
I think I would, too. I agree.
Manny is the better defender. I think he brings more defensive value. He can actually play short, which he may eventually do for the Orioles, assuming he stays there, once J.J. Hardy is no longer playing the position. But I think Manny is the better all-around player. I think he's going to age better. And again, Harper, I've made this point before, he ranked in 2016 19th among all major league outfielders in OPS, just behind Michael Saunders, behind Jose Bautista, also behind Jay Bruce and Yasmani Tomas. Again, good player, but .814 OPS and a .243 batting average does not get you $400 million. It is, to me, a massive question Harper has to answer. And I realize, justifiably, listen, he's won an MVP. He's one of the youngest MVPs we've had in this game. And I think he's benefited to an extent with that comparison to Trout, because we've sort of elevated both of them. But I think it's been a mistake when we talk about the big two, Harper and Trout, and not the big three when you add Machado in there. And really, it's Trout above them both, I think, from a standpoint of career achievement. But I, again, if I had to rank the three of them right now, I would go Trout 1, Machado 2, Harper 3. And I think, guys, it's maybe even a bit of laziness, I'll say, on the part of the media, maybe not necessarily in baseball, but generally in the U.S., that we have gotten used to talking about Harper and Trout in these terms without really paying attention to what Harper has done.
Yeah, that's a great point.
In my view, he does not deserve that same billing alongside of Trout, and I actually would say there are a number of players in this game, Machado being one of them, Nolan Arenado being another, Francisco Lindor being one more, who I think right now I would plop down my money and buy a ticket to watch play before I watch Bryce Harper.
That's a great point, John. Listen, we appreciate you doing this. Thanks as always. Have a great weekend.
My pleasure, and as always, great questions from both of you, I promise.
Take care.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it. Thank you.
It's John Paul Morosi, MLB insider for the MLB Network, schooling me on New France.
I love that New France drop. He makes a really interesting point, though, on Bryce Harper in that every time you read these stories, they're always linked. And if you look at the statistics, they shouldn't be. Mike Trout is clearly one, and then there's a drop, and then you start thinking about whether it's Harper or Machado. But Mike Trout is truly the best player in Major League Baseball, and he's 100%. The best player by a lot.
Yeah, I don't think that there's I'm with John. I think there's a considerable drop-off after Mike Trout. But
Harper's what do you do if you're in the Nationals, though? He's your franchise guy, but he's not a $500 million player, whatever that crazy number is.
He's a franchise guy who hasn't been able, and it's not all on him, obviously, but he hasn't been able to take his team to a title. The team has been well-funded. They're owned by the single wealthiest owner in baseball, in the Lerner family.
Yeah.
It's not the slam dunk it used to be. The thing that I think Bryce Harper has going for him is Bryce Harper is a brand. And I'm looking particularly at a team like the New York Yankees. He's got two more years of this rebuild. By the time he becomes a free agent, if you go around the Yankees lineup, they're going to have a bunch of young players. And, you know, if it all works out, they're going to have a bunch of young players on probably below market contracts or close to below market contracts. You're going to need somebody to excite the fans in New York. Manny Machado, and New York smart baseball fans, Manny Machado would excite them. But Bryce Harper gives them that Mickey Mantle-esque guy.
Yeah.
And I think part of the equation with Bryce Harper and Mike Trout, and this is by no means, you know, a statement on race or anything like that, but I think the fact that Mike Trout and Bryce Harper, I mean, they're both white American players. I think that it's natural that they're going to be linked when you talk about the two best players in the game.
Yeah, the one quick thing, Mike Trout's a New Jersey guy, so that's a factor. I don't know if he wants to come back to where he grew up. And the thing about Bryce Harper, which you just hit on, which you are correct, he understands the importance of marketing in baseball. He has talked about that the sport is not marketed well. He's willing to go outside of baseball to promote himself. That is a great fit for New York. Mm-hmm. That's a guy who, like Matt Harvey, kind of wants to be part of the big city.
He wants to embrace what it means to be a New York athlete.
Personality-wise, he would fit really well. The Yankees do have the money. That appears to be, as you look into the future, an interesting possible fit.
You know, and I know we're up against the clock here. We'll take a break. But the only thing that I would think that might maybe change the equation a little bit is if one of these young guys that the Yankees have really turns into a star. I mean, if Gary Sanchez is just this transformative, player, then maybe the Yankees start thinking, okay, we have the face of our franchise here.
Right.
Maybe it'll be somebody else, and maybe we'll look elsewhere. But it is a fascinating point. And 2 years ago, you couldn't have an argument on it. 2 years ago, people would go, you nuts, Manny Machado or Bryce Harper? Jesus, give me Bryce Harper. Jenny Vrentas, a senior writer at Sports Illustrated for the Monday Morning Quarterback. The conference finals go this weekend for pretty good quarterbacks in those games. Jenny Vrentas will join us when the Jeff Blair Show with Richard Deitch continues on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
This ain't like when you're at a game and sign up for a credit card just to get the prize and then you immediately cancel the credit card. Because there's no prize when you sign up for our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. Now more of the Jeff Blair Show on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Muffle the drums. Behold the new century comes. Was it all the amphetamine presidents and their busy wives? Or did Manhattan crumble the day Marilyn died?
All right, welcome back to the Jeff Blair Show with Richard Deitch, Corey Hirsch, Garrett Joyce, Dave Schilling, writer at large for Bleacher Report. Ahead, it is conference championship weekend in the NFL. The Atlanta Falcons against the Green Bay Packers. That'll be the 3 o'clock game. The New England Patriots and the Pittsburgh Steelers. That'll be the night game on Sunday night. Richard, safe to say that I think a lot of people expect lots of offense, certainly in the Green Bay Atlanta game.
Yeah,
and I think it's realistic to expect close games too.
I hope so. A Falcons Packers when they played back on October 30th, 33-32 Packers win. You know, Matt Ryan and Aaron Rodgers, particularly Rodgers, are playing at just an exceptionally high level. So I would expect I would expect whatever the over is to probably be topped in the Packers Falcons game. And we'll get to with Jenny on this. Mm-hmm. Very tough to figure out the Steelers Patriots just because when you go back, no Roethlisberger, no Gronkowski, I think no Le'Veon Bell in that game too. So it's hard to know what we're going to get just because the game is going to be so different than what it was before. But we're great quarterbacks. The NFL's lucked out. This should really be a great weekend for them.
Let's bring in Jenny Vrentas. She is a senior writer for Sports Illustrated and the Monday Morning Quarterback. Jenny, thanks so much for joining Richard and myself. It's great to talk to you today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys.
So how much of a difference? Let's look at New England and Pittsburgh first, because Richard referred to the fact that when they met, no Roethlisberger, no Le'Veon Bell, who, you know, I mean, I saw a couple of interviews in the NFL Network this week where, you know, people were saying that he is just such a different package, a difficult package for teams to handle as a running back right now. And some people are saying could be the best Steelers running back since Franco Harris was running roughshod. How much of a difference can he make in this game? Is it enough to get the Steelers over the Patriots, or is it still going to come down to Roethlisberger versus Brady?
You know, the reason I think it's probably not enough is just last week's game. You know, despite all the explosive weapons that the Steelers offense has and having, you know, Roethlisberger and Brown and Bell on the field and for the same time in the playoffs, you know, they still only scored 18 points against the Chiefs. And that's an excellent Chiefs defense, and it's particularly a Chiefs defense that's very good in the red zone and has held teams, you know, has kind of kept them out of the end zone. But, you know, the Patriots defense is also very good at that. You know, they give up yards, but not a lot of points. You know, obviously the lowest number of points in the league this season. So I just don't think it'll be enough going into Foxborough. And I also kind of think, you know, you hear things come up during the week, you know, hard to tell how much they'll play into the game. But this flu bug that's going around the Steelers locker room, that can't be a good thing either.
Right.
Mm. You know, Jenny, I think if we would, you know, because the quarterbacks of each team are so great, we may actually give the underdogs in this game probably a little bit more credit in terms of having a shot to win on the road. You know, the Patriots are favored by 6. And here's the one I want to get to, Falcons, Packers. I think there's a bit of a perception out there because of how hot Aaron Rodgers has been and because they knocked off the Cowboys at home that you may look at Green Bay as, you know, maybe either the favorite or having a big chance to win this game. But I look at the Falcons' offense, Jenny. First in total points this year, second in total offense. Matt Ryan playing at a ridiculous pace. If this wasn't Aaron Rodgers maybe coming off the Cowboys, I think a lot of people would be talking, or at least more people would be talking about the Falcons. Is it possible we have overlooked them this year as a team that legitimately may be the best team in football?
The Falcons have been overlooked all season. I agree with you there. And I think that's just because they're they're kind of a, you know, one of those teams that's not a national team. They don't have a national fan base. And the other reason, obviously, is, you know, this role that Aaron Rodgers has been on the last 6 weeks. You're right. It does feel like going into the game, people are kind of expecting, well, how are you going to slow Aaron Rodgers? But, you know, I think there's a couple things that, you know, the Packers are really banged up. They've got a lot of injuries. And certainly their last Super Bowl, they made a habit of overcoming that, and it hasn't hurt them, you know, to this point in the postseason. But the other thing I think you reference is just the explosiveness of that Atlanta offense. There's so much speed there that I don't know if the Packers defense is capable of managing it. You know, we obviously saw a shootout when the teams met earlier this year. And I kind of like the Falcons in this game, despite the fact that Aaron Rodgers is playing perhaps as well as we've seen a quarterback play over, you know, an 8-game stretch. I still like Atlanta for all those reasons.
Jenny, one of the things we saw was the Texans were able to put a little bit of pressure on the Patriots, certainly to rush Tom Brady a couple of times. Is there anything Pittsburgh could take from the success Houston did have against New England and apply this weekend? Or are we talking, you know, two different defenses, two different groups of players?
Well, you're right. I think there is something to take from it. And it's kind of the formula that anytime we've seen Brady be slowed in the postseason, it's always kind of getting, yes, edge pressure, but also pressure up the middle. That's where he's really affected, right? So if you can kind of move him off his spot in the middle of the pocket, that's where he's most susceptible. And, you know, when the Giants upset to the Patriots, you know, when the Jets with Rex Ryan beat them, it was all the same thing. It was just kind of getting him seeing ghosts a little bit in the pocket. And, you know, Houston got some really good pressure up the middle, you know, and they were kind of pushing the guard and center back a little bit. And I think that's where we see Brady be effective. Now, you know, he's pretty good at adjusting, and I will say that this year they have the advantage that they didn't have last year. Dante Scarnecchia, the offensive line coach, you know, veteran offensive line coach, he returned to the Patriots this season, and we all remember what happened in last year's AFC Championship game, right? Like, Brady couldn't do anything because the pressure was just getting to him, both inside and outside. And so I think this year they'll have a better plan because they have an excellent offensive line coach who's going to go into the game with the better plan. And I also don't know, I mean, certainly there are good rushers, you know, obviously James Harrison kind of ended the game for the Chiefs last week, but I see them being better able to handle that this week against the Steelers.
Jenny, where are you going to be based this Sunday? What game are you at?
You know what? Well, we're starting our Super Bowl road trip from New York on Monday, so I'm sitting out championship weekend, so we're going to, whatever teams are in the Super Bowl, we're going to hit the road Monday and try to tell some interesting stories along the way from their hometowns and high schools and colleges. So that's what we're planning for now.
Okay, so as you're watching this game from whatever location you are, if you had to make a prediction, what game do you think is the closer game and why?
Closer game, yeah. I'm going to go with the NFC game.
Mm-hmm.
I think that one's going to be closer. I can just see the Patriots pulling away from it. You know, I think there were opportunities that last week, you know, we saw Alex Smith miss a few things, and, you know, there were obviously some miscues on that Chiefs offense. And I think a lot of that Chiefs offense, I think Alex Smith is underrated. I never understood quite all the hate for him, but Brady's obviously a different level of quarterback. And I think some of the things that Chiefs didn't quite take advantage of last week, Brady will take advantage of. So I could see them pulling away with that one, whereas I think the NFC one would be pretty tight.
Jenny, listen, it was great of you to join us. Really enjoyed your stuff in Sports Illustrated, and it was great to have you on the show. Travel safely and enjoy the Super Bowl.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate you having me on.
Take care. That's Jenny Vranta, senior writer at Sports Illustrated, the Monday Morning Quarterback. A very, very talented writer, I might add.
Columbia University graduate.
She's managed to overcome
another add her to the long line of posse. She's great.
Yeah,
and
she
actually
is
a better person than writer.
You didn't You weren't, I know you're an adjunct at Columbia. She was out well before you got there. Well,
she's younger than me, but she is part of the same. We all took the same very famous sports professor in grad school, a guy named Sandy Padway, worked for Sports Illustrated, New York Times.
Yeah.
So she's part of the same lineage that I am.
Oh, cool.
She's younger than me, but we all took the same class, basically.
Yeah. Excellent.
Yeah.
That's a great school. Corey Hirsch, former NHL goalie and goalie coach, will join us. Garrett Joyce, we're going to talk about a series that Sportsnet is running on the economics of junior hockey in Canada and that lawsuit that former junior hockey players have filed against the Canadian Junior League. And then at 11:35, Dave Schilling, writer at large for Bleacher Report, did a terrific article on the new age of athlete activism in the NBA, particularly cogent, particularly timely today with the inauguration. All that ahead in the Jeff Blair Show with Richard Deitch on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.